Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.
Once again, it is time for Inside the Game. We get to talk sports. Love it. I'm Pat Williams, your host. And this is AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Jeff Sennis doing our engineering again. Andrew Herdliska does the producing. And I want to introduce you to Dr. Timothy Baghurst. He is an FSU coach at Florida State. He's a professor. He's a president of kinesiology, an author. What a guy. And we've got the next half hour with him. His book is called Reflections on the Coaching Life, Volume 1, 90 Daily Thoughts to Help Coaches and Sports Professionals Improve Their Craft. Tim, welcome to Orlando. I'm so happy to catch up with you.
Well, thanks for having me, Pat. I appreciate it.
What a life you've lived. What a resume. I mean, what's the story here, Tim?
Well, when I came through my education, coaching education didn't exist. And like many coaches, I was an athlete. I grew up loving sports, wanted to participate in sports, realized maybe in my early 20s I wasn't good enough to make it, so to speak, and wanted to stay in sports and continue being involved. And at that time, there really wasn't coaching education as we have it today. And so one of my goals over the course of my career has been to help develop that coach education and help coaches who may be in situations where I was, where there just isn't the support for coaches in their locale, their region, and be able to provide something where they can just get better at what they do.
Do you believe that coaching is one of the hardest professions in society?
That's a great question. Yes, I would put educators in general up there, and I think that's what coaches are. We are educators at heart. I came through, I was a teacher before I became a professor, and there's so many corollaries that cross over. We are in the helping business, but especially in the United States, coaching is a venerated profession, but we don't necessarily have the infrastructure in there to support the coaches. And as a consequence, many coaches are working full-time, coaching on the side, or if they are coaching full time, they're not being very well paid for it. And there's a huge responsibility to take care of athletes, to be their counselor, their educator, their support, without necessarily perhaps the infrastructure in place that they really need to be successful. And that makes it very, very difficult and also very stressful. Stress and burnout is probably the number one thing I'm asked to speak to coaches on around the country.
How did this book come about?
Over the past 4 years, I've been at Florida State for almost 5 years now. And during COVID, I should clarify that I run a center here for coaching education called FSU Coach. Within that, we have a master's program. And during COVID, we were all stuck at home, and I wanted to be able to provide our students with something that went beyond my own education. If my classes are only based on what I know, then all students learn is what I know. And I wanted to go beyond that and explore what other people know and bring that into our classroom as well. And so I started interviewing sports professionals around the world, owners, athletic directors, coaches, athletes, you name it, just to learn about their experiences across different sports, what they learned, et cetera. And I've got almost 150 interviews on our YouTube channel, podcast. Did one this morning, actually, with an MMA coach in Florida. And while they're great, they're also fairly lengthy, and they don't always have those constant gems of knowledge in them. just like this conversation. Not everything in this conversation is going to be noteworthy. So what I did is I said, I wonder if I could create something that takes the best of those interviews, that takes the best of the books that I've read over the last 15, 20 years, and put it into something where we make it succinct for coaches. Because let's be honest, coaches are busy. They don't have time necessarily to sit down and read a 200-page book. How can I make this something that coaches will enjoy reading, but don't have to read a lot at once? So I took what I thought was the best of these interviews, took the best quotes from the books I'd been reading, and put them into its own book with kind of this idea of, you may remember the Chicken Soup for the Soul books.
Sure.
Tried to present it almost as a journal where one a day you can go through 2 minutes, read through a quote from somebody, a reflection on that quote with some questions at the end that ask you, how do you learn from this? And so somebody can either race through it, or they can take 90 days to just one a day go through and look at different topics, whether it be how we coach, nutrition or strength and conditioning, or so many different topics covered. The idea is just to get coaches thinking about the way they coach. Maybe they can't enroll in a master's program like ours. Maybe they don't have the funding or the time. All right, get this book. You're going to get better from this book. And it's only going to be 2 minutes a day for 90 days.
How do people get the book?
It's on Amazon. Very easy to find. Baghurst is not a common name. So if you just typed Baghurst in Amazon, you would find the book pretty quickly.
Timothy Baghurst, Baghurst, Reflections on the Coaching Life, Volume 1, which obviously means, Tim, there's a Volume 2 in the pipeline, right?
You're absolutely right. I'm on, I think, number 17 of 90, and my goal is to get that out in this year, in 2024, because there's been so much. I've been really blessed to have so many great sports people on my show, and they've offered so much great information that I want to make sure that everybody's content is out there and put in something that, again, makes it easy and accessible for coaches, because we are busy as coaches. We have very hectic lives, especially those who are doing this as a part-time job. It is very, very difficult to get coaches into professional development when life, kids, family, and job interfere with that. So I tried to make this as succinct and as simple as possible to help coaches just get better at what they do.
Tim, you've whetted our appetite. I want you to pick out one of your favorites out of these 90. Just pick out one and share it with us. Love to hear it.
Just give me one second.
I'll let you be the judge on what we should hear today.
I'll give you a quote. Okay, I'm just scanning through. I had an athletic trainer who is a high school athletic trainer, and he said this: the new and upcoming pressure for athletic trainers is name, image, and likeness. I understand athletes have obligations to fulfill their NIL deal. But if the athlete cannot perform to their peak, why put them back in competition to risk having them sidelined for longer if they can just wait an extra week? I've had unbelievable pressure from coaches and parents to allow a star athlete to compete when they weren't medically healthy enough to do so. I've been threatened and told by the parent that I was denying their family opportunities for generational wealth, and that I was responsible if their child lost NIL deals because of their injury. So that's a quote from this athletic trainer, and then of course I spend a couple of paragraphs discussing what this means from a coaching or sports professional perspective, and then ask the questions at the end. How would I describe my relationship with my athletic trainer or medical staff? Do I support their decisions both privately and publicly? Do I serve as a buffer between athletic trainer, medical staff, and the athlete's external influences such as parents and agents.
Well, I would say, Tim, that was a great example. I want more. You've whetted my appetite. give me another one. I need that inspiration. And one of the things that comes out of this, Tim, it appears, is wisdom. And we all need wisdom, don't we?
Yes. And we need, again, this comes from reflection, right? Mm-hmm. This is, the purpose of this is not necessarily to provide some new scientific discovery or to provide best practices for doing this and this or seven ways you're going to succeed here. This is more a case of asking, who am I as a coach? What do I want my athletes to look like? What do I want to achieve? And then how can I think about what I'm learning here and apply it into my own setting? Here's another one. You asked Joanne McCallie. She was a basketball coach for Duke.
Yes,
For many years.
I know
she
her.
Wrote a book. Yeah, she was on my show. She wrote a book called Secret Warriors.
Yes.
And I pulled this out of there, and she said, the secret is learning how to say yes and how to say no.
Mm.
I took great pride in saying yes to all of the invitations, despite my already packed schedule and my need to have quiet time with my daughter and husband. You want to focus and just go on to the next event, but try to pace yourself, young aspiring coach. Pause. Learn how to be still.
Great. We got to take a break. Dr. Timothy Baghurst is our guest. We're talking about his book, Reflections on the Coaching Life. I'm Pat Williams, your host for Inside the Game. We talk sports every weekend right here on AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be back with Tim. Stay with us. Williams here, Inside the Game, the name of the show. Dr. Timothy Baghurst, our guest, his book, Reflections on the Coaching Life. Tim, I think you'll be interested in this. On February 7th, in the New York Post, there was an article about Andy Reid, the coach of the Kansas City Chiefs. Travis Kelce says this about his coach. He doesn't switch it up, man. He knows one way, and that's being himself. That's why we love him, man. And that goes along with being that leader. He never falls away from being himself. He's always going to be real to who he is.
Mm.
And then a good quote, and here's another Kelce quote about Andy Reid. His motivation is to put a challenge right on the table and say, this is what we got to do. This is what I need you to do. And how are you going to figure it out? And I'm challenging you to do that. And then one other quote, George Karlaftis, who was a rookie last year for the Chiefs. We have a lot of respect for Coach Reid. Everybody's like, we don't really want it to disappoint him. Whenever he says something, you do it. No questions asked. Interesting observations on a NFL coach, huh?
Sounds like somebody has developed a quality culture.
Yeah, and they have, obviously. And then Blake Bell said this about his coach. At the end of the day, everyone wants to play for Andy Reid, and everyone wants to give their all for him.
Indeed.
High praise, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something that has clearly been acquired over time, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A lot of people expect a culture to be developed in weeks or maybe even months, and we see that particularly in professional sports, where if a coach is not successful immediately, then they're considered on the chopping block without really understanding that the development of culture and maybe changing a poor culture is going to take time as you migrate players through your system as you maybe offload players who don't fit into your culture. And I think longevity there has shown that Andy Reid has really developed something that has become very successful and very special.
Tim, I'm interested in this. You're the director of FSU Coach Interdisciplinary Center for Athletic Coaching. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. Yes, we started this when I came to FSU about 4.5 years ago. My dean noticed that just a lack of coach education around the country. I'd been at Oklahoma State University running coach ed programs there, and he asked me to come to Florida State and do something different. And so what we did is we built academic programs. So we have an 100% online master's in coaching, which is about 2.5 years old. And we have an online graduate certificate, which is about 60% shorter than the master's degree, which is also online, so that we can meet students wherever they're at, wherever they're coaching. They don't have to come to Florida State. So we developed those programs out, and we have roughly about 80 students in those programs now, across levels, from volunteer coaches to all the way up to D1 head coaches and beyond. So that's been really exciting to see. All different sports as well, volleyball, ice skating, jiu-jitsu, football, you name it. But then we also wanted to do outreach. We wanted to provide best practices, coaching, education, and development to the communities as well. So that's why we started the center. So, for example, earlier this week, I was in Hernando County speaking to the school district. Mm-hmm. The coaches and athletic directors in that school district. Last month, I was in Sumter County doing exactly the same thing. And next week, I'm going to Jacksonville. So this is really how does our center not only bring students in, which of course a university needs to do from a financial point of view, but then how do we also meet the needs of the community by being able to provide resources and best practices out to coaches in Florida and beyond. And that's been a fun challenge to have. Coaches in Florida are generally not particularly well supported. They don't get as well paid as they probably should. Yeah. And so it's been great to be able to go out and provide support to coaches who otherwise wouldn't be able to receive it.
How will history remember Coach Bobby Bowden?
I think with fondness. He had retired before I got here. He is obviously in Tallahassee, is legendary. And if you read any of his books, which I have, and in fact, one of his quotes is in my book. He really cared about his players. And you just talked about Coach Reid and how the players clearly care about Coach Reid. Why do they care about Coach Reid? It's not because of the power he holds over them. It's because they want to perform for him. Well, if you have a coach who loves you, who cares about you, you have that belief, that want, that desire to really perform for that coach. And you'll hear expressions, of course, as you well know, I would run through a wall for that coach kind mm-hmm. of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what Bobby Bowden inspired, because he cared so much about his players that in turn meant they cared so much about him. And I think he's going to be remembered for a very, very long time.
Tim, there was another legendary Florida State coach that just passed away recently, the baseball coach, Mike Martin.
Yes.
Any thoughts?
Yes, I did have the privilege of meeting Mike Martin very briefly. He was a big supporter of our center. Actually, he was one of the first people to actually come out and support the center's creation back in 2020. Again, these great coaches leave legacies, not just because they were successful on a field or court or wherever it is. It's because the impact they had with the athletes that they worked with. And we so often see a tandem between an athlete's, a coach's care of their athletes and a coach's success. Sometimes coaches can be successful without having great relationships with their athletes because their athletes are just incredibly talented, but it's rarely sustained. And that's what we see with these great coaches is sustained success so often because they've developed great relationships with their athletes. Yeah, a John Wooden, of course, who can forget John Wooden and, you know, his care of his athletes and how that translated into success.
Mm-hmm.
So coaching really is a caring profession. I don't think coaches get into this profession because of other things such as financial success. If they do, most of them don't survive very long.
Listen, the most money John Wooden ever made at UCLA was $35,000 a year. He made more in retirement, you know, writing books and all. So he was not in it for the money. He had to have outside jobs. He delivered milk in the morning, you know, early in his career at UCLA. It's unbelievable, you know, what coaches at that point had to do to support their families. A little different now.
To some extent, yes. You know, if we look at collegiate, for example, especially D1, but my understanding, you know, if we look at Florida, the average stipend for a coach in schools is about $2,500 across the board.
Why is that, Tim? Why did you mention Florida's just not doing a good job there for coaches? What's the story?
Well, obviously, I'm concerned about Florida. Living and working in Florida now, Florida is a concern for me. Another concern, if I just put it financially, it's very hard for me to go and ask a high school coach to enroll in a master's program that they would probably have to pay for when they're getting very, very little financial support from the school. Mm-hmm. I had a county athletic director on my show last week, and the quote was about a nickel an hour is what coaches are making. Coaches are doing this because they love kids, they love sports, they love what they do. They're not doing it for the money. However, we have to do something about that because if it's at some point coaches may be asked to do too much or they say, I'm neglecting other things such as my family. And if coaches I had a coach tell me recently that he spent more money on gas to and from the facility than his stipend paid.
Boy, that's amazing.
If we want coaches well-trained, if we want them coaching professionally, we have to recognize the efforts that they're taking and the sacrifices that they're making so that coaching becomes more venerated than maybe it currently is. And again, going back to this interview with our county athletic director, she told me we used to have 50 applicants for a head coach football position. Now we're lucky if we get 10.
Mm-hmm.
Because coaches look at the cost of time and even finances and go, I don't know if I want to do that anymore.
Tim, so, we got to close, but here's a quote from the great Vince Lombardi. They call it coaching, but it's really teaching. And here's another quote from John Wooden. I was teaching these young men under my supervision. I love that quote. Teaching these young men under my supervision. So I think the great coaches always view themselves as great teachers.
100%.
So isn't that great? Dr. Timothy Baghurst has been our guest. Interesting. The book, go get it, go up to Amazon, Reflections on the Coaching Life, Volume 1. We've got more here on Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. And this is AM 950 and FM 94.9. The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
You've returned here on Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and of course you're listening to AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Dr. Timothy Baghurst, our guest in that first segment, talking about his book, Reflections on the Coaching Life, Volume 1, 90 Daily Thoughts to Help Coaches and Sports Professionals Improve Their Craft. Well, we go from Tallahassee, Florida to Washington, D.C. I want to introduce you to Ben Rothenberg. Tennis is his bag. And his book is out, and boy, what a book it is. Naomi Osaka, Her Journey to Finding Her Power and Her Voice. Ben, welcome to Orlando. Nice to catch up with you.
Thank you for having me here, Pat.
How long did it take to put this book together? What did you learn from it? And why was it important to do it?
Yeah, so this book probably all in all, I mean, I had the idea for about a year before I finally started working on it and got the deal to write the book from my publisher. And it probably took a little less than 2 years, I think, overall to complete. The first part of which was I spent on tour largely shadowing Naomi through the 2022 season, and then I spent a lot of 2023 actually synthesizing the stuff I learned and all the interviews I'd done and putting it into book form. And yeah, I'd wanted to write a book for a while, and Naomi, I think in a lot of ways, was the most compelling person or character, if you want to say, who had emerged on tour in my time covering the sport. I mean, I covered tennis on tour, traveling the tour for about 12 years or so. Mm. And a lot of the players who were the big stars actually during that time were players who were already around even before I started. You know, some of the incredible longevity for players like most prominently Venus and Serena Williams, other players like Roger Federer as well. They had been around even before I got on tour in 2011 or so. And so Naomi was the one person I felt like I really saw, from seed to being in full bloom or full blossom as a player, and seeing the transformation she'd had over her career. I felt like I had some pretty unique insights on her journey and her trajectory, and also realized as I was thinking about this that there was a lot I still didn't know about her and about her early life, especially including in a lot of which was spent in Florida. So there was a an opportunity, I thought, to take this really talked about person in sports and wider culture as well, and be able to inform and illuminate a lot of stuff that hadn't previously been shared.
Tell me about her life in Florida.
Yeah, so like a lot of other tennis players or tennis parents, really, of aspiring tennis players, let's say, the Osakas were drawn to Florida. It's the hotbed, for tennis, not only in America, but largely around the world. I mean, players come from all over Europe and Asia as well to train at various Florida academies, and some of the big ones, the most famous ones, like IMG Academy, which was formerly Nick Bollettieri's place in Bradenton. There's Saddlebrook in Tampa. There's the Chris Everett Academy now in Boca. There's a lot of different places around the sport. Those are the sort of A-list, really kind of VIP academies. And then all over, one of the things I learned in this is all over, certainly like Broward County, Palm Beach County, there's a lot of smaller pop-up operations just from coaches working full-time, during school days with kids in public parks around those places. And that's sort of the class that the Osakas were in. They really were just bouncing around courts from various public parks and really sort of low-level, let's say, coaches or coaches without a lot of pedigree or real name-brand value was how they spent their time training, and with their father as well. So they moved to Florida, partially for the weather and the climate, and also just knowing the tennis coaching and competition opportunities were unparalleled. They lived in Long Island before that, and there was not anything like that in Long Island, certainly not year-round. But Florida is really the mecca of tennis. If you have a dream of making it in the sport, people think it's where you have to go.
When did we know, Ben, that Naomi Osaka had some special skills and really began to emerge? How did it happen?
I think there have been flashes of it a few times earlier. People who had seen her following the tour closely had seen the kind of raw talent she had and the raw power she could hit with, hitting forehands, over 100 miles per hour, which is very rare in women's tennis. But then I think the wider stage really got to know her probably in 2018 when she was started that year ranked 70th in the world. And then she won the title in Indian Wells, the big tournament out in California near Palm Springs. Then she comes to Miami and beats Serena Williams in the first round. And then a few months later, she beats Serena Williams in a super contentious
U.S. Open final, which was a dispute between Serena and the chair umpire that Naomi was nearby for, not directly involved in, but the amount of attention and firestorm that that match generated, I think, really launched Naomi as a sort of rocket pad, you know, into a much higher orbit than she would have been just from winning the U.S. Open under less controversial circumstances. So she became kind of a household name in the U.S. By the sort of chance of that, and then she consolidated that with great results in the future as well. But it was an interesting moment in her trajectory where this thing that this dispute between Serena and the umpire that didn't really directly involve her actually really had a transformative effect on her life and her level of celebrity, let's say, and attention, which for athletes, you know, especially in an individual sport where sponsorships are such a big part of the business, that really put her on a different plane.
How did she handle that?
It was tough for her, and a lot of parts of it were tough for her. It was very overwhelming. She's a very naturally shy person. That's one of the things that I was most interested in tracking in this book, is because she had been such an overwhelmingly and admittedly shy person, you know, throughout her life, and she had a very sheltered childhood where she wasn't really interacting with many kids. She didn't go to traditional school from the time she was about 8 or 9 years old. Once she moved to Florida, she only did online schooling, so she didn't have a normal, you know, setup of friends or classmates or anything like that at a school. And so the transition from that to being a superstar was intense and jarring, as it is for a lot of tennis players, even who have less extreme, let's say, isolation in their childhood. Still, that level of sudden fame coming at you can be a lot. But for Naomi, I think she's been more open about how she struggled to grapple with that and the pressure she puts on herself, and that she perceives from the outside as well to be perfect or winning all the time, or a certain kind of expectation. Has been something that's been difficult for her.
Ben, if we could sit down and have lunch with Naomi Osaka, an hour and a half later, we would leave. What would our impression be of her?
I think one of the things that always strikes me about Naomi is that she is both quiet but also very confident, and both shy but also very revealing in these kind of interesting, fascinating, contradictory, potentially, ways. You know, she kind of is a sort of Teddy Roosevelt style, speak softly but carry a big stick sort of personality in a lot of ways. She's comes off very self-effacing, but also there's this real core of self-confidence that really powers her. And she has not a lot of filter, which made her a joy to write about, because she said all these incredibly revealing things in various interviews and even press conferences over the years, really letting you know how she feels and not trying to put up fronts or facades about herself. She can be very raw and very revealing, even at times where it's probably not beneficial for her to be as open or as honest or as vulnerable as she lets herself be. So I think that, yeah, you'd be struck by that in getting to spend time with her in this sort of lunch situation where, yeah, some things that she would just say certain things that would seem not ostentatious, let's say, in her delivery, because she is pretty soft-spoken, but once you let them kind of marinate and reflect on it, I think you'd be pretty struck by her self-belief and her sort of core of faith in herself.
Ben, will she be the face of women's tennis for the next decade?
Time will tell. I mean, I think she was the face of women's tennis in a lot of ways for, let's say, the previous 5 years or so, once Serena Williams stopped winning Grand Slam titles and, you know, including losing a final to Naomi. I think Naomi really was the prevalent player in women's tennis in the culture for a lot of periods over the last 5 years. And now she's just started her comeback. And so we'll see. I think on a certain level, she does need good results to regain that sort of preeminence and that relevance, you know, getting back, let's say, at least into the top 10 or so. And that won't be easy. It's not been easy for many players who are coming back from maternity leave, which is what she's doing now. But she has the potential. She has that, I think, a pretty singular thing in women's tennis right now, which is that sort of pop culture crossover appeal. And that is a big part of the tennis package, certainly in the vein of Serena Williams and Venus Williams, you know, that sort of almost like pop star energy they bring to the court, and that individual personality and charisma is a big part of what's made women's tennis this unique vehicle for making superstars out of female athletes.
Ben Rothenberg is with us. He's the author of the book, Naomi Osaka, Her Journey to Finding Her Power and Her Voice. I'm intrigued with that subtitle, Ben, finding her mm-hmm. power and her voice. What does that mean?
Well, power, I mean, first of all, it's just even on the court. I mean, Naomi is one of the physically strongest players on tour and has been for her whole career. And strength that combines into hitting the ball hard. It's not always just visible big muscles in tennis. It's a lot about, you know, timing and fast twitch and racket head speed and all those sorts of things that really make for the most powerful players. And Naomi discovered she had that within herself as a teenager. She'd been a pretty sort of defensive player by nature early on in her early teens and had to learn to realize that she did have this raw power within herself, and then learn how to harness and then make it so she wasn't just a sort of, you know, machine gun spraying everywhere, that she could really refine and hone this weapon that she had in her shots into something that could be effective over the course of a match. So that's part of finding her power. And then also she found her power by finding her voice, the second part of the subtitle, speaking out about causes that were important to her, whether it's mental health, she's brought up and generated a lot of conversation about various things about racial justice and police violence that she also foregrounded at points in her career. She sort of realized the platform that she'd earned through her racket could be in turn used to shine a light on other causes off the court that she thought were important as well.
Ben Rothenberg is our guest. We have another segment with Ben, and so much to cover, so many interesting things to talk about. I want to ask him about his time in Australia. Just gotten back from Melbourne. I've never been to Australia, Ben, but I'm very curious to hear about your thoughts about that country. Also, when we come back, I've always been a huge Serena Williams fan, and I'd love to get your insights on her.
For sure.
The person of Serena Williams. Who is this woman? I'm Pat Williams. The show is Inside the Game. It's AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Ben Rothenberg is the author of the new book, Naomi Osaka, Her Journey to Finding Her Power and Her Voice. Ben, first of all, tell us about Australia. You spend a month there. What's that country like? What are the people like? What's going on there?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think the first time I went to Australia, I've been to Australia, I think, 11 times. That was my 11th time going down there. And always, you know, around the month of January and always around the tennis tournaments that are happening there to kick off the season in the middle of their summer. Australia, in certain ways, it feels like you can travel a very long way. I mean, it's about more than 20 hours worth of flight time just in the air, not even counting the connections you have to make to get from where I live in Washington, D.C. to the east coast of Australia. And then it's you kind of go a long way to get somewhere that's not that different. I mean, they speak English, the food and everything is relatively recognizable to what we have in this country. It's easy to communicate, easy to get around. They drive on the left side. That's one sort of quirk, and you have to be careful, you know, crossing the street and things like that when cars are coming from different parts than you're used to. But in a lot of ways, it's a very comfortable, familiar country. There are certain, you know, quirks about it for sure, and certain kinds of ways in which I think that Australians have, certainly compared to D.C., and I think it varies even within the U.S., but certainly compared to where I live in D.C., the baseline stress levels of Australians are much lower. They're much more relaxed and much more chill about things, and you know that can be a nice, refreshing change. Other times it can be, you know, frustrating if you feel like you're standing there tapping your foot, waiting for things to get done when they don't seem like they're in a particular hurry. So it's adjusting to a different sort of rhythm and pace of life. But I really like it. I really like getting to spend, you know, 3 or 4 weeks there a year to start off my year and to avoid a month of the cold in Washington D.C. January every year. It's been a pretty great deal.
And Ben, it's amazing the athletes that come out of there. Baseball players, basketball players, tennis, golfers. I mean, on and on. I mean, it's quite a sports country, isn't it?
Absolutely. And Melbourne, especially, actually, I think views itself as the sports capital of the country and also the world. I think they really take a lot of pride in how much they foreground sports. They have those sports you mentioned. They have other sports that are more unique to Australia, like Australian rules football. It's a huge deal domestically there, cricket and rugby as well. They in tennis, obviously, they're great swimmers. They do all sorts of things really well. They were the first city in, I guess, the Southern Hemisphere to host the Olympics, Melbourne, back in 1956, which was a big deal for them to get themselves on the sporting map. And they're hosting, they've hosted one more since then in 2000 in Sydney, and they're going to host again in 2032 in Brisbane. Mm. And this is all from a country that's about, population-wise, probably about the same as Florida. I'm guessing it's about 26 million people. Mm-hmm. So it's not an overwhelmingly big place in population. It's very sparsely populated. The whole sort of middle section of the country is totally empty, wasteland kind of in the outback largely. And it's not really, it's a big, huge desert. And so just a few cities along the coast of the sort of the capitals of the six or seven states in Australia. And yeah, but they've, with that lack of quantity, they've developed a lot of quality, certainly in sports, and there's, you know, great economy there and very successful country in a lot of different ways. And an increasingly, you know, diverse country as well, too. They get lots of immigrants, especially from Asia, which is pretty nearer them than it is to the U.S. and on a similar time zone, which is pretty attractive for, you know, immigrants these days who want to be able to be in the same time zone roughly as where they came from to be able to, you know, make phone calls home and things like that. It can be seen as less disruptive to move to Australia than to move to the U.S. or Europe, let's say. So it's an interesting place for sure. And yeah, sports is something they take very seriously, and sportsmanship, and they have a lot of pride in their sporting heroes.
Ben, tell me about Serena Williams, the person, the human being. Who is this lady?
She's been a lot of people over the course of her life, for sure. And she's in this interesting moment now where she's finally retired after, you know, at age 40, spending so much time on court, playing really well throughout her career, finally retiring at the 2022 U.S. Open in September of, about a year and a half ago now almost. But she's been this, you know, singular figure in the culture, I think, who became this dominant champion in tennis and also had this personality she built, which was, you know, very powerful and very unapologetic in a lot of ways, and could be very polarizing for some people, for sure. There are people certainly who don't like Serena and didn't enjoy her, what she brought to the court, and others who found her incredibly powerful and inspiring. And for Naomi Osaka, as I mentioned with the book, Serena was a hugely formative person in her life. I mean, Naomi's father basically saw the Williams sisters on TV in playing doubles in the 1999 French Open final, and looked at his own two daughters and said, "Hey, I wanted to turn you two into tennis players just like them." So Naomi was really very intentionally built as the younger of the two sisters, especially in her family, to be in Serena's mold, in Serena's shadow, in Serena's, you know, form. And so Naomi has incredible respect for Serena and really adores her. And that's been an interesting twist to their rivalry. It's not at all the sort of heated rivalry that you'd expect. It's almost more like a, as Naomi herself has described Serena, as her tennis mom or her motherly figure almost in her life, which is a unique situation for on-court rivals who do have done battles at a couple, you know, major events with huge stakes on the line.
Ben, so when a woman like Serena retires from the circuit, mm-hmm. does she ever pick up a tennis racket again and just paddle around and just play around? Or is it all over?
Yeah, she's posted a couple of videos of herself doing that. I think that she has played some at home. You know, she has a daughter, and it's possible that she's going to play with her two daughters now, actually, rather. And one of them I know is old enough to be playing tennis a bit. And so she'll probably get out on court with them. And her sister, her older sister, Venus, is actually still not retired yet. And she's even older than Serena. She's, I think, 43 now, Venus is. And I think that Serena's gotten out there and hit with Venus a bit some in retirement, but nothing too serious. And Serena also, you know, got pregnant again fairly shortly after retiring from the sport, which was part of her plan, and not something she wanted to have, you know, have to come back from again in her life. So I think she's somebody who I think still sees tennis as fun. There are certain players who have very complicated relationships with the sport, you know, especially those who had their whole lives orbit around tennis since a very young age in their childhood, sometimes not by their choice, when it was their parents who sort of foisted tennis upon them. And some players don't pick up a racket again, but Serena, I think, has, you know, at least held a racket a few times in recent years. And other pros, you know, play, you know, exhibition events, you know, sort of like any sort of senior athlete can sometimes for appearance money and such. And Serena hasn't done that yet. I wouldn't expect her to, really, but it is something that some other players do.
Ben, is there a bevy of outstanding young women tennis players coming up through the pipeline that you can already identify?
Absolutely. No, there's a huge, I mean, really once Serena retired, the group that's been on top of the sport has been very young. You know, on the U.S. side, we have Coco Gauff, who's still a teenager. She's turning 20 finally, I think, next month. But she already won the U.S. Open last year. She made the semifinals in Melbourne last month. She's been tremendous, and she's, again, someone else who followed largely in the Williams sisters' path and legacy. And, yeah, a lot of young players from around the world as well. I mean, that's one of the things that's been tough for Americans in tennis, is that just the footprint of the sport is much bigger than it used to be, you know, 50 years ago, let's say, when players like John McEnroe and Chris Evert were dominating. Now there's players from all across Eastern Europe, especially, who have made their mark in the sport, and still lots of them coming through the pipeline. China, in women's tennis especially, has been increasingly on the map. There's just a Chinese woman who made the final of the Australian Open. So it's a big, you know, tougher landscape out there, and a lot of people from all over picking up rackets and being inspired to try to be the best.
Ben, why is it that I prefer watching the women tennis players than the men?
That's not uncommon, honestly. There's a lot of people who have that, and maybe it's a better question for you to articulate, but you know, I think a lot of people relate to and the pace of the women's game. First of all, a lot of times the men's game can be very serve dominated and just be a lot of aces or points to end after one or two shots. And there can be a lot more rhythm in the women's games with longer rallies and more visible tactics, let's say, and you know, point construction and things like that. And then there's a certain, you know, amount of grace or fluidity that sometimes women's tennis has that men's doesn't always have when it's more explosive and yeah, a bit more staccato sometimes. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on why you think that is, but it is something that's definitely not uncommon among men and women who watch tennis.
I think the men are just too good. and the matches are so much longer. I mean, they can drag on.
Yeah.
Oh boy. I mean, it
those best of five matches can be really arduous to fit your day around if you want to watch one, even just on TV.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I've got 4 hours to devote to a men's match.
Right.
And it can be that. But boy,
definitely.
But boy, they're powerful. They're superb athletes. That's for sure. So Ben,
definitely.
Is there another subject that you'd love to dive into their life and explore it from top to bottom? Is your appetite whetted?
My appetite is whetted. I definitely enjoyed the process of doing the book and of getting to dive this deep into a topic. I mean, I'd previously been a newspaper writer, like I said, and doing, you know, much more short turnaround things of kind of a story per day, roughly, when on assignment at a tournament. That is a different sort of pace, and getting to do something that was much more full and much more fleshed out was definitely fulfilling for me. I don't know what the next topic will be. I haven't really thought of that yet. It's been still less than a month of this book has been out in the world. So I'm going to try to not rush anything and see what I gravitate towards and what inspires me in the weeks and months ahead to latch onto a next project.
Ben, what do you want readers to take from your book, Naomi Osaka?
I think I want people just to understand the sort of price that athletes pay to chase these dreams. And that's a big part of it. You know, we see the triumphs and the glories of it. And sometimes we see the players losing on court, obviously, in the agony of defeat in that classic sense. But I think just sort of the way that your life has to be radically shaped by choosing to chase this dream. And that goes for all sports for sure, but I think especially in a sport like tennis, it is individual and does start out as it, you know, early in childhood. You have to really start playing if you want to be one of the best players in the world. Seeing how that can affect a person, I think, can be pretty, pretty stark and pretty staggering.
My guest, Ben Rothenberg, the book that he's written, and it's a good read. It's a big book, but thorough and very, 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 very interesting. Naomi Osaka, her journey to finding her power and her voice. Folks, you've been listening to Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. We do this every weekend, so we'll be back next weekend on AM 950. FM 94.9, The Answer, with more good sports talk. Have a great week ahead. Good sports talk.
Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.